Welcome to our podcast for Raising Arizona Kids Magazine. I'm Vicki Belint. It's a teacher's utopia and a parent's dream, and it offers what every child deserves, a chance to fall in love with going to school. Desert View Learning Center, a small private K-4 school in Paradise Valley, Arizona, began nearly 40 years ago when a few dedicated teachers hoped to create a place that would launch young children on the path to a lifelong love of learning. Pia Jacob has taught and directed at DVLC since the school was first formed. It's one of those rare schools where teachers simply stay. Four of her colleagues have taught there for the past 25 years. This year, however, Pia will begin the transition to retirement. She talks about why teaching children to read is top priority, how parents have changed over the years, and why supporting classroom teachers is key to helping young children learn and grow.
I'm Pia Jacob, and I'm the director of Desert View Learning Center, which is a small private school in Paradise Valley, Arizona. I attended school in New Delhi in India, and it was an Episcopal girls' school, and it was delightful. My mother was the principal of the school, and it went up to high school, so I did go through school over there. I enjoyed school a lot. Being in a girls' school gives you a lot of freedom, and there are co-ed schools in India, but not one that any of my friends went to. They all went to gender-specific schools. And I think in a culture like India, that is more the norm than it is over here.
What was it like going to school with your mother around?
The building that I was in was on a different campus when I was young, till I was about 14 or maybe about 12. I was not on the same campus that my mother was at. And then when I was in high school, it was fine. She was around. I think it would have been awkward if I wasn't a good student. I think it would have been embarrassing for her. Maybe I wouldn't have been that conscious of how awful it was for her. But since I was a good student, it was okay.
But that sort of was mother kind of tied up with school. Sometimes that's a good thing.
My mother was tied up with the school. And I felt sometimes that she bent over backwards not to show favoritism. And that hurt sometimes, because sometimes you know you had done the very best in the group, but you knew you weren't going to get the first prize because you were the principal's daughter. So that wasn't good.
So talk a little bit about what drew you to the United States then.
Actually, I came to the United States because my mother was going to do a job for the New York State Department of Education, and I had just finished my bachelor's degree, and the school that I was going to go to learn how to be a teacher didn't start for a few months. So my mother's philosophy was that you couldn't finish your education unless you'd seen the world, and so she brought me to the U.S. with her.
And you stayed?
And I stayed. And it just unfolded that way, one led to another. And, so I ended up staying, and they ended up going back after her work was done, after a couple of years. And here I am.
And you followed in her footsteps, it sounds like, because you also are the head of a school.
And I didn't realize I'd followed in her footsteps until I had followed in her footsteps, which is, except in a lot of ways, this school is very different, because hers was a much, much, much larger school, and it went up to high school. But as far as focusing on education and seeing it as a way to mold lives and guide people, yes, very much.
I guess start with talking about what Desert View is and what its philosophy is, how it started.
Desert View was started by a couple, Mark and Joni Scher, who moved to Phoenix from New York. They had been working in New York just for a couple of years. Back then, this was in the early 70s, there were a few writers writing about education and the whole public school system and how mind-deadening it was and didn't look as the way children actually learned. And so there was this movement to try and make schools a little more child-centered. So Mark and Joni came out to Phoenix and decided to start a small school where they could teach the way they felt children learned. And they had one other person who worked with them. I didn't get to meet him. And that's how they started Desert View.
And that was back in the 70s.
In 1973. So the school has been here in Phoenix for a long time.
And you began teaching here around that time?
I began teaching here. I was taking some courses at ASU, and Mark was one of my teachers for a methods class, a teaching of math class. And he told me about an opening at the school. And so I came and started working here the following year.
Tell me a little bit about how Desert View is different.
Well, one of the ways it's really different is that we teach the academics individually. So, especially reading, we focused a lot on reading, fluency, comprehension, and that works best if you are doing it one-on-one. And we see reading as being crucial for all academic success. So we don't use textbooks. We just use interesting books at the level that children read, whatever level that may be. It has more of a relaxed atmosphere than a lot of other schools. And a lot of the relationships that we build are individual relationships, real specific to each child. And I think that's different. A lot of times teachers address a class, and here we address a child.
And you're able to do that because of the class sizes?
The class sizes and also a lot of parent involvement. When we meet with parents who are thinking of putting their children in this school, we make it clear to them that to be part of the school, they need to sign on to coming in and pitching in because of this one-on-one reading program. That means you have to have an adult there listening to the child read or to ask comprehension questions or to correct inflection. And so if you have enough parents on board that morning, you know, let's say you have three or four parents and they're two teachers, you can get through a lot of children one-on-one reading to you, which is impossible to do in a large public school classroom.
So let's go back to the whole idea of the focus being on reading and the one-on-one. It sounds simple. It sounds like almost a luxury to be able to do that. Why does that work so well? Why the focus on that?
I think the most important part of learning how to be successful in school is feeling competence. And if you can't read even the calendar or what the schedule for the day is, you'll be somewhat bewildered all day long. But once you can do that, it opens up the whole world. I mean, children can feel independent and competent. And so if we can get that set early on, which is really at kindergarten, then I think children can figure out a lot of the rest of school if they can just read and read independently and feel confident that what they've sounded out in a word is what's going to happen.
So the schools remained small, about the same size as when it started? Or?
Oh, no.
No.
It was tiny.
It was even smaller.
Oh, I think there were about 12 or 15 students when it started. But I think Mark and Joni were very committed, no matter what, to doing it, to just hanging in there, and they did. So in the end, Mark did leave and got a regular job in a public school. But By then, the school had started, it was able to take off. And we knew that we'd come up with a way of teaching that was going to have the results that we needed. After that, Joni left. She wanted to pursue a career in art. And that's when I took over. I was teaching kindergarten and running the school. And then we hired Jack. So, you know, it's been a long time building it very slowly, just, you know, one child at a time.
One child at a time, one teacher at a time. Now you have how many teachers?
There are about 10 teachers. And now I'm not in the classroom anymore. So that's a huge change to just be able to run the school. I'm in and out of every classroom all day long. So I know all the children know me. And there are a lot more teachers. I mean, we have virtually every classroom has two teachers. May not be two classroom teachers, but we are able to break out. So for example, in fourth grade, Jack is the classroom teacher and he keeps his children for math. And Pam takes them for language arts. So she takes half the class for an hour and he keeps half the class and then they switch. So, you know, for a lot of the core subjects, the teacher has 9 to 11 children.
You hear a lot about school, about teacher-student ratios and how class sizes are growing larger. Have you happened upon the key?
I think this is the key. If you have a handful of children to teach, you can attend to every child's need or reiterate something while the other children are still working quietly. You can spend that one-on-one time. But if you have 30 children, I mean, even if you have a whole hour, that's only 2 minutes per child to fix something or to re-explain or sit calmly and not, you know, I mean, teachers are human, and if they feel they're failing, they get agitated too, leave alone what a child's going through. So here you have the time because you have the extra hands on deck, and that makes, I mean, you know you can succeed because you can spend the time to succeed.
So let's talk a little bit about the role of the desert, because mm-hmm. the school is on this property where there is just basically, I guess it's, you'd call it the raw desert.
Yeah.
And you use it a lot. Talk about that a little bit.
We use it a lot, and it's what children who went to school here 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago remember as the most vivid, joyful impression of their early school years. We've left it the way it is so that children have the experience of climbing trees and looking down on the world. You know, that whole birch, it's fantastic. So they can spy on everybody. You know, from a child's point of view, and maybe people on the East Coast have big trees and the children climb trees, but here they're just not that many. So we have some good old Palo Verdes, we have some good mesquites, and the children love climbing in them. And they also have the most beautiful, imaginative, changeable play structures. So they can have bakeries, they can have castles, they can have forts, they can have shops, they have makeup, you know, the beauty parlors, I mean. And so it's wonderful because they can create out of some trees and some logs and rocks and whatnot, just whatever their mind wants to create. And, you know, that completely constant moving piece is just not available if you have a puppet show or a theater, you know?
Or recess on a playground.
Yes, but they just play with balls.
But what does that actually do to, if you will, a child's brain as they're growing and developing, to have that uninterrupted time to I'm sure they're imagining.
Exactly. They are creating a very, very strong, wildly imaginative world, which is not created by somebody else telling them how to play, but by themselves creating it. Also, I don't think you can ever have a true environmental mindset if you haven't been in the real environment, because a playground with a rubberized play surface is not real world. I mean, why would you save a tree if you've never been in a tree? So that's really important. And I think you breathe differently. There's no stress. I mean, sitting on a log is different from sitting on a chair. And a lot of people, even just going down into the desert, just up from where our school is, just walking those few steps, instead of going to OT, you just learn how to do that quick balancing because you're running down into the desert.
So you don't need a therapist to teach you.
Yeah, you're just getting it. And when we take the children on hikes, you know, a lot of our field trips are not to museums or, you know, these children are blessed. Their parents go to museums. They take them to museums. But what a lot of parents don't take them on is hikes. So all our children, even the kindergarten children, go on hikes carrying their own backpack, carrying their own water, and they hike for about 4 miles. So being in nature is one of the most important things, we think.
So let's contrast that with the typical, say, public school or charter school, where there is a different kind of curriculum where the children don't have access to the desert and they do get their 20 minutes of recess. How is it different for those children? What does that do to a child's growth and development? When some would say that that's good because that's the way real life is, that you're going to have to get into uncomfortable situations that you're not really wanting to be in, and you have to learn and you have to be responsible. You have to report certain times. The world doesn't always go the way you want it to.
I think we're trying to see it more from how it feels for a child to be penned in. And sometimes you hear, and this might be more drastic than it is in most places, but the more a child wiggles, the less recess they get. Here we feel, if a child is wiggling and wriggling and, you know, that they probably need to be outside to let some of that steam escape in a child-appropriate way. I mean, they're obviously not ready to settle down and work, so why punish them by making them settle down and work? And our results have shown that the children really do study hard and do well if they've had some freedom. And one of the things in our desert, we don't hover over them all the time. We want them to have some freedom to develop their own instincts. There are some rules. They follow the rules. But they're able to manage their behavior better because we've trusted them to do so. There are a lot of studies, and you keep hearing about how, you know, children, you know, nature deficit disorder, and I think it's real. I mean, everything around you is becoming asphalt and parking lots. And I mean, even if as a grown-up you drive into a national park, you breathe differently.
So schools in the Valley have changed quite a lot over the years since you started teaching. Public schools have increased, but also charter schools have taken a foothold in the Valley. Has this growth affected Desert View in any way? And what's your take on how the whole growth of the Valley has affected the way kids are educated?
I don't know if it's that much about the growth in the Valley. I think as far as all the different choices, such as charter schools or all kinds of schools, I think if parents educate themselves about the different schools that are available to them, either near their home or not, I think most parents make good choices. And it's interesting when parents do that, So then they're looking at their individual child and finding a good fit for them. I think long ago, only wealthier parents could choose a private school, and the poorer people didn't have the choices that they do have now. So in that way, charter schools have come up with some good ideas. Not all of them were well regulated when the charter system first came to Arizona. I think that has been rectified now. So there are more, it's provided more choices.
So how have families and parents changed over the last 25 years since you've been teaching? A lot of changes. It's a whole generation.
Yeah.
What have you noticed?
Parents are less comfortable being parents now. They want to be their children's best friend. That's a very, very different type of parenting. Very, very different. Quite often, parents are a little older, or they've had a career. Maybe the moms, if they are planning to stay home, have done something after university and now are choosing to start a family. But a lot of the parents are much more permissive than... Parents were much stricter when I first started teaching. And it's interesting because when you've taught in the same locality, and it's always been a private school, you've seen pretty much the same types of families that send their children here. So it's good to watch that and to note how parents are parenting differently now.
How does that affect what you do in the classroom? Or does
it? It does. Parents were more authoritarian when I first started teaching. It was more similar to my upbringing in India. Now parents are more permissive, but just as anxious about the output. So they still want their children to do academically, to do really well, but they don't realize how much work that's going to take if they truly want to have those good results. So you can't let your child play video games and watch television and play on your cell phone and all of that and do well in school. So some of that negotiation we have to teach the parents.
You actually teach the parents to help them be more authoritative.
Mm-hmm. And to let them know that their children can't make all these decisions at this early age. I mean, there are just way too many temptations now that weren't there. I mean, when I started working here, computers were just mainframes. So this wasn't an option. Now you have, I can be talking to a parent here and there'll be a two-year-old sibling playing on the iPhone. That never happened before. I mean, they sat and scribbled. Or they played with a couple of dolls or toys or blocks. So this lack of focus is telling. Reading is not as high a priority in most homes as it used to be.
And reading is the core, as you say.
Reading is the core.
What's most overlooked by educators, parents, politicians, in terms of educating young children, if you could change anything about the way children are educated, what would you change?
I think in large schools, teachers have to get the support. I think that without that support, a demoralized workforce, an underappreciated workforce, is the death knell. I think until parents see what a... It's a labor of love. I mean, even in a school like this, where we have, definitely parents who are, parenting with great consciousness, teachers who are well-trained, dedicated. But if the parent doesn't support what you're trying to do, you can't make any headway. I mean, the thought of teaching in a large public school out of the goodness of your heart and then getting no thanks for it, or being berated, or, you know, reading articles one after another written by people in, you know, government, it's a tough job. So I think that would be, whether it's a teacher in a private school or a public school, I think teachers need the support of the parents.
So do you think when your mother was teaching and when she was the principal back in the day, do you think that she was more supported than, I know it was a different country and culture. But has it changed?
Yes. I think even in India, though in India, teachers are seen as somebody very, very worthy and held in high esteem. But I think that is something that all parents, whether you're a single parent or a parent from a really wealthy family, it doesn't matter. I think if your child hears you talking disrespectfully about your teacher, it's hard for them to walk in the next day and listen to the teacher with any sense of polite attitudes or the desire to please that person. Why would they if they've just heard you at the dinner table berating them or saying, you know, and there's no point in that. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all here to help the child mature and go through school and do well. So I think a lot of the tone in public discourse, dumping on teachers or teachers' unions or whatever it is, you very seldom hear public officials saying, gosh, you know, you couldn't pay me enough to go work a month in that school. Nobody ever admits to that.
Yet you've been teaching for so many years.
Because we've been able to do it here the way we want to. We knew right away this was one of the core principles, I think, of Desert View was it'll be a teacher-run school. So it has to work for the teachers. The teachers have to be happy working here. And then my job is to tell the parents how to get behind what the teacher is going to do. So it's not a school for placating parents or we know how to get the results that we need to show, but we need to have the parents behind us. You know, my job as the director has been to make sure parents who choose Desert View understand that we're the people who are making the decisions and we're looking for their support. And when you've got that, just that correct mix, it's an absolutely utopian teaching environment. It couldn't be sweeter. Every teacher knows what their children are supposed to know, you know, as far as curriculum and state standards and national norms. We know that parents are driving their children to school, picking them up, and paying good money to send their child here. So we have a very high responsibility to make sure that at the end of the day, their child is well prepared. And because our parents are on campus enough, they know how we're doing it. They talk to the older students, they talk to children who graduated, and they know that the results are there. I don't know if this can be replicated on a bigger scale. It works because there are only so many pulses you can keep your finger on. And I think that's one of the magic components is do it right, do it small. Don't do it to get rich, but do it right. And if it's small enough, I think you can. But we don't offer everything. You know, you choose what you're going to offer and stick with it.
And what do you think that your mom would have to say about your place right now where you are in terms of leading the school for so many years?
I think she'd be pleased. I think she'd be so thrilled to know that I found my passion and my It's not just a passion, but like, gosh, I got it. Because you do touch lives. I mean, you know, I think when you hear from a child, you know, suddenly somebody will knock on the door and a young boy will be standing there. And you look at them and you think, oh gosh, you know, who is this? And then he'll show you his learner's permit. And you think, gosh, you know. And they come here to show us these little times in their life that they're now achieving their freedom. And you think, ah, you know, that's why you do it. It's this connection and it's very loving. And you've loved a child. So, and their parents. I mean, you know, there are lots of parents you meet over the years. And yesterday we had a party for children who were just leaving high school and going into university. And there were all these children we haven't seen for, you know, years.
Since they were 10.
Since they were 10. And now they're 18. And the joy that we all shared again yesterday was just the same as when they left here. And that's special. And I think that part of that is because it's such a tiny school. It's like a family. In some ways, it is like a family. I'm sure there are families with 100 people in them. You know what kind of family reunion would be like this? Yeah. It's been a great career. Just a sweet school, touching lives. Nothing could be more precious, I think.
Check out our August issue where you can read about bullying in Arizona and 11 who took a stand. More at raisingarizonakids.com. I'm Vicki Belint. Thanks for listening.
Raising Arizona Kids Radio is a Small Change production. All rights reserved. This material may not be broadcast or redistributed without permission.